Welcome to the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. I'm Morten Jensen, and alongside me, Brian Suporek and Sarah Chilea. How are you guys?
Doing well, Morten. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thank you, Brian. Sarah, how are you?
Hey, guys. I'm good.
Sounds good. So, this is our first official podcast for B-Ball Breakdown, and we've just been so creative in naming this podcast the NBA podcast. You know, it's awesome. I like it, personally.
Sounds iconic.
Short and sweet.
So let's start up with the Golden State Warriors. I mean, I've had them at 75-7 for the past month or so, but a lot of people have been lashing out at that, thinking they're going to finish with a lower total. And that might be true, given that they have to meet the Spurs two times around. But, you know, the Spurs might sit some guys. Could we be looking at the first team ever to win 75 games, Sarah?
It's certainly looking very, very possible, even likely. As you mentioned, the Spurs are most likely going to sit people those last couple games. The only reason I could think of that Pop might not sit people is just trying to keep in a rhythm. Other than that, I don't think he's petty enough to be worried about their record. And I don't think that he's concerned at all about the Spurs going undefeated at home. So, yeah, I mean, the Warriors still have four meetings with teams who are going to be fighting hard for a playoff position. They got Boston and Portland and Memphis twice. And they've been looking a little more vulnerable lately, but they still find ways to pull out games. So, no, it's very likely. The question might be, are they concerned with winning everything they can? Do they want to win out and get 75? Do they only care about getting 73? I don't know.
That's a good question, actually. I would imagine that you want to win as many games when you're in the 70s, because when you're there, you sort of like have to go all the way. Right. I don't think after hitting 70, you get satisfied. I think they want to take it all the way through. And like, think about it. Back in 95, 96... winning 72 was viewed as something that would just never be able to be broken.
Right.
Now we're looking at a team that might win 75, and the obvious question arises, Brian, can 75 be beaten?
No way. There's absolutely no way. There's nothing. I mean, it's just the confluence of events that led to this year's Warriors team, even with the salary cap exploding, are just never going to happen again. You're never going to have the best player in the league on such a below market contract. And because Steph is signed for $11 million, they can fill out the roster with guys like Iggy, who would be starting for 15, 20 some teams. He's coming off the bench. You know, you have a bunch of guys still on their rookie contracts, Harrison Barnes, Festus Ezeli. They're helping fill out your depth a little bit. So I would be absolutely shocked if we ever saw someone top whatever the Warriors are going to do this year. I don't know that I have them at 75. I'm leaning 74 just because those two Spurs games, I could see them splitting, especially if Pop doesn't rest his starters in one. But, you know, they have Boston, Portland, Minnesota at home. Boston and Portland are scary, but Portland, you know, they were the ones where Dame just absolutely lit them up. So I think there's a revenge factor there. Boston took them to double overtime and softened them up for their first loss, so I think there's a revenge factor there. I'm really just curious to see what Pop does, if he rests starters, and where he does it. Because, you know, I could see him saying, I want to play my guys at home, so the Warriors are still scared to come to San Antonio if they can't beat us twice there. But I could also see him saying, I'm going to rest him at home because we already beat him there before, and I'm going to play him on the road. And if we can beat them in Oracle, that's going to plant just a little seed of doubt in their minds if the two teams do meet up in the Western Conference Finals.
Right. I don't know if Pop even is interested in playing them hard out there. But I don't have the schedule in front of me. Which game is the last one? Is it in San Antonio or in Oracle?
In San Antonio is coming up before Oracle. The Oracle
Okay.
one is the second to last game of the season.
Depending on how many days they're going to have off between that last game of the season and start of the playoffs, he might go for that one just to give them one more good hard competition before they have so many days off for just practice.
Yeah, it looks like they play Sunday, April 10th is versus Golden State in the Bay Area. Then they have OKC and Dallas Tuesday, Wednesday. So if he plays them, Golden State, and then rests them those last two nights, they get basically a week of rest before the playoffs.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely not playing, we know, the back-to-back full squad both times. I don't know.
If I'm Pop, I'm gonna go all out in Oakland. I wanna put some scare into the Dubs at home at Oracle. Even if they lose, I want them to just go full strength, pedal to the metal, just to like show Golden State that we're right here. We are right here alongside you, not beneath you. We are right there alongside you. And then for the game in San Antonio, I mean, sure, Pop would probably like to have a perfect home record. Who wouldn't? But I don't think that carries a lot of weight on his mind at all. So, we'll see. But certainly, two of the most intriguing games for the remaining season. It's the perfect way to close out the season, basically. Two of the best teams, like, ever go head to head to close everything off and to just give us, like, a taste of what's to come in the Western Conference Finals. I mean, you couldn't have written a better script. I am completely in love with the NBA schedule from here on out.
Especially when Boban plays 35 minutes a night in both games. It's gonna be lit.
I want him to start next year just because. I mean, I love that dude. His hand, have you seen his hands?
They're unreal.
I mean, they're the size of my table. It's just, jeez. So moving on to another good team. Fantastic team, rather, especially when you look at their raw level of talent, the Oklahoma City Thunder. They're kind of tricky because they have some firepower, but Serge Ibaka, their third guy, who's been their third guy in what feels like forever, has come out and thrown a little bit of shade at the organization, or Russell Westbrook, or Kevin Durant, or whatever. He just doesn't want to stand in the corner and wait for it 8 minutes, which is kind of understandable. And it also goes in hand with the fact that his numbers have gone down, and they have gone down for 2 straight years now. 2 years ago, he had a PER of almost 20, and now it's down to 14. His numbers per minute has gone down, and when you watch games, he also looks to be less involved. How concerning is that for a team like Oklahoma City, who relies already on two guys, Sarah?
I feel like, first of all, if they're playing the Spurs, Serge is going to go like 8 of 8 from the field and destroy us anyway. So, but no, it is a concern, especially if he's not feeling involved. And not only not feeling involved, he's actually not involved. But that's why, to me, nobody wants to play that team ever. But I don't think they're as scary as they have been in years past. They still have the same vulnerabilities that they've had. Like you said, they still rely too much on those two guys. They have more offensive potential now with Cantor and Ibaka if they choose to use him. Waiters if he, is having a good night. But yeah, they still, when the game slows down, they go into that ISO ball that they've always gone into, and the defense is highly suspect. So I don't think they're as big of a threat as I've felt like they were in years past, even.
Yeah, I keep trying to buy in. I think they were my preseason champion pick. Like, I've been sold on them for so long just because in the playoffs it does seem like talent wins out over everything. And if you have two of the best players in the NBA, like more often than not, that works out for you. It has been a little disconcerting to see Serge. Just he really doesn't seem as involved or like as high motor as he usually is, and that's his game. Like, he doesn't need to score 20 points and grab 10 boards, but he needs to at least put that fear in your mind that if you're driving into the paint, he's gonna reject your shot. And it seems like he's just not quite there. That said, prior to Tuesday's loss against Detroit, they had won eight straight, and Russell Westbrook had been a triple-double machine. And Tuesday's loss came without Kevin Durant and Serge Ibaka, so it's not like I'm really sweating a late-season stumble when they're missing two of their top three players. I think the thing to watch for, especially in a series with the Spurs, is if Billy Donovan really decides to go small ball and put KD at the four and Ibaka at the five, because I could see at least them holding their own, even if Aldridge and Duncan are the guys they're going against. It's going to be tough, admittedly, but I think if you put Westbrook, I would say two floor spacers, but they don't really have those. But like maybe Dion Waiters and Andre Roberson with Durant and Ibaka in the front court, that's going to present a matchup problem for the Spurs, I think.
You could throw Anthony Morrow in there as well. If you look at a guy who can really stretch the court defensively, he has some issues, but at least he's not Andre Roberson from downtown, who's like 30% or something like that. But yeah, I would agree with that mindset. I hate the fact that they traded DJ Augustine. I know that he played horribly for them, but he really picks it up whenever he gets traded, it seems. And for now, he's really balling out in Denver. If he had been as effective as he is in Denver, yeah, he would have been an obvious choice to actually pair Russell with, and you could have gone super small, super quick, because you would still have Ibaka to protect the rim if teams went by DJ. So there are a lot of elements at play here. But even so, I just have a hard time seeing the cohesiveness on this team compared to San Antonio, compared to Golden State. It seems like, as you touched on earlier, Sarah, that they really take turns playing isolation basketball. And this has been a frequent critique of them for the last 5, 6 years, I think. So this isn't news. The question now becomes, how do you change that? How do you make these two individual great stars somehow get on the same page and run a system? Because that was the whole attraction of getting Billy Donovan in there. Remember how much people were hyping up the Thunder, like, oh, they're going to run system sets now. They're actually going to run plays. I mean, they haven't to the extent that I thought they would. Yeah, I've seen some things here and there, some small wrinkles that I liked, especially Durant setting some pin down screens and that he didn't use to do. But outside of that, it hasn't really been a whole lot. And I'm kind of concerned that their weak link right now is just that lack of cohesiveness, as well as, the coaching, basically. I don't know how you guys stand on this, but I mean, I personally just feel when I watch Oklahoma that there's no team chemistry, and that sounds weird for a team that's like, yeah, what are they right now? 52 and 23, but they just get by somehow, some way, and there's just not really any logic to it. It's all talent, all shooting, and all Russell Westbrook doing Russell Westbrook things. You can't rely on that.
I'd agree with that. You do get the feeling when it comes down to crunch time that they're kind of making it up as they go. And in the playoffs, when it comes down to who's going to blink first, if it's them versus the Warriors or the Spurs, you have to take the Warriors or the Spurs in that situation.
Yeah, especially because both teams have defensive options to shut down Westbrook and Durant. Like the Spurs can put Kawhi on Durant and then Danny Green on Westbrook, and that's you're not going to stop those guys, but you're at least going to make things challenging. And then if they get by the Spurs and meet the Warriors in the conference finals, you have Klay, Iggy, Draymond, all of whom can throw different looks at both guys. So I agree, it'll be a challenge for sure. I still think they're of any team left outside of the Warriors and the Spurs, they're just about the only other team that wouldn't surprise me if they won it all. But I wouldn't go into the playoffs saying they are the favorite by any means. I think they're definitely a tier behind both the Warriors and Spurs.
I have a feeling Pop could surprise us a little bit by putting Kawhi on Russell Westbrook at some point, and then run Draymond Green on Kevin Durant. Just to give them a different look, and just have Kawhi claw his way against Russell Westbrook each time down the court. Could you just imagine, Kawhi with the 6'7" frame, quick instincts? I mean, I'm not saying he could take Russell out of the ball game, but he could make the initial dribble up slower. He could get them into their set slower and just get the clock down to a respectable level for what the what the Spurs wants to do. I'm not sure that you really have an answer for Kevin Durant, even if you put Draymond on him. But if you can affect Russell Westbrook and the tempo of which he plays in, I think that's basically key. Because he's the guy who creates all these transition baskets. He's the guy who really crashes into people, gets to the rim, collapses defenses. If you can just keep him on the perimeter 10% more than what he is right now, then you have like a leg up.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Pop actually has done that. He did that a lot in their last meeting in San Antonio. He had Kawhi on Westbrook and Danny on Durant. And it worked pretty well, so I'm sure he will play around with that if they should meet again.
And as it stands, the Spurs and the Thunder would meet in the second round, so basically there's little to no chance that OKC meets the Dubs at all.
Yeah, I mean, even if they do, I feel like that Spurs series is going to take so much out of them. Like, that's the brutal thing. Like, the Thunder are a really good team, but having to play back-to-back series against the Spurs and the Warriors is just like, how the hell does any team survive that?
That's really where I'm at, because when people come up with a different winner in terms of, you know, not being Golden State or San Antonio, you have to realize something. At this point, this late into the season, Golden State and San Antonio have lost a combined 19 games. For anyone to get past both of those squads, you have to win eight. Eight against those teams. That's not happening unless someone of significance goes down. Let's just call it like it is. If someone goes down badly, I should add, then yeah, they have a shot, but it would have to be like in two straight series. I get what you're saying, Brian, in terms of like OKC is the one team that potentially could, but they're still so far off. It's quite unrealistic when you look at it, really. I mean, they've already lost 23 games. They have some left. I think they played 75. Something like that. I just don't see any way possible that they're going to go as far. And Cleveland and Toronto either. I'm just looking forward to the NBA Finals actually being in the Western Conference Finals, because that's really what it's going to be. It should just change the entire format. Okay, so moving on. Cleveland, I just touched on them, and there's been a little bit of, I don't want to say criticism, but Zach Lowe came out with a piece where he just point out some stuff that could be problematic, and one of the things that he touched on was their problematic front court and how Kevin Love is basically being paid way too much money to do what he really does, which is not a critique of Love, but his role. He basically is a glorified Al Harrington out there. So what can Cleveland even do to get into this conversation, Bri?
Can they go back to the trade deadline and trade Kevin Love for someone? Or could they go back 2 years ago and not trade him for Andrew Wiggins? I mean, yeah, like you said it, the roster just doesn't fit all that well together. And, you know, Zach's column covered a lot of that. It's just you have three or four guys, all of whom are best suited to play the four, including, you know, LeBron James. But if you put Love at the five, your defense is going to be a turnstile if someone gets past your perimeter defenders. And it's also not like Cleveland is only two games up on the Raptors right now. It's not like they have the number one seed locked up. So at a time where they should be playing at least like they have something at stake, you know, they lost to the Brooklyn Nets the other week, like the Brooklyn Nets. And then they lost or gave up a 20-point lead against Houston and lost that game. That granted, LeBron James is not playing, but those are not great signs when you're 2 weeks away from the playoffs. Like, if momentum is such a thing, they have none of it.
Yeah. That's the interesting thing about them is clearly they're still the favorites to make it out of the East. But when you look at them, do you think that they're a better team than they were last year or even as good? So far, it does not look that way. It's like they're falling behind the level that they were playing at last year. They didn't get better, and that was the goal. So everything is obviously not running as smoothly as it could be running.
I think a big thing, you know, last year they had their hand forced a little bit by the Love injury in the playoffs and then Kyrie in the finals. Obviously, you don't want two of your theoretical top three guys going down, but they played pretty well without Love, and it forced LeBron to take on more of a role at the four. So it makes you wonder, like, should that have been a sign? Should they have said, oh, we don't need Kevin Love to go to the finals. Maybe we should get a few more wings to back up LeBron and to take some defensive responsibilities off of his hands. And maybe that'll force him to play the four more, which is absolutely, he should be a full-time four. Like, what is he doing at the three anymore? He needs to be the four. He needs to be Cleveland's version of Draymond Green. So until the Cavs rectify their front court logjam, which they can't do until the offseason at this point, it does make you wonder if they kind of missed their shot this year.
And just to add, last year they went 53-29. When they fired David Blatt after 41 games, they were on pace to win 60 games. I didn't understand that fire, but I suppose it was because of team chemistry or lack thereof. Players were not listening to him or whatever. But Tyronn Lue, who's taken over, is 22-11. So basically he's lost the same amount of games as Blatt did in 41 games. I'm not sure that was in any type of upgrade. I mean, sure, maybe team or players are getting along with Lue a little bit better, but that has come at the expense of victories, and you have to, like, at some point ask yourself, will those victories come back to bite you in the ass, especially come playoff time? Because if the Raptors overtake the first seed, that's not really where Cleveland wanted to be, you know? So how about that coaching there, Bri?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you trust Tyronn Lue to pull them to the finals, or are we just ignoring coaches at this point and thinking LeBron is just steering this team and he's the one who's the GM, the coach, the star player, the all everything?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the difference between Blatt and Lue, because with Blatt, they were both fifth and offensive rating and defensive rating. So they were a top five team in both categories for the first half of the season. With Lue, they're second in offensive rating, so their offense has improved at least a bit, but they are 13th in defensive rating. So what they've gained on offense, they've lost on defense. And Lue started off by promising he would get Love more touches at the elbow, and he did for a little while, but then that's gone away. It just doesn't seem like he has a great grasp on this roster, which is completely understandable for a coach who came in midway through the season and is a first-time head coach. You know, at least Blatt had a year and a half of experience. The guys might not have liked him all that much, but I think there is some value in him having been a fall guy. Basically, you know, you can kind of take the heat for the losses, and then it shields LeBron, it shields Kyrie, it shields Kevin from that type of criticism. And also, let's remember, like, last year, sorry to bring this up, Morton, but last year, game four, I believe, against the Bulls in the second round,
yeah,
Blatt calls a timeout that he didn't have at the end of the game.
Yeah.
Should have been a technical foul.
Yeah.
Bulls should have been up 3-1 in that series.
I remember.
So that's a rookie mistake for a guy who had the full year of experience and then had, you know, decades overseas. You know, are we sure that Tyronn Lue is not going to make a similar mistake in a crunch time situation in a one possession game in the playoffs?
Yeah, that's certainly a tall task for a guy to come in, his first experience as a head coach, midway through the season, to take a team to the title. I wouldn't want to be in that position, but I just don't think that you can give him the edge, obviously, over the coaches that he's going to be facing if they make it all the way to the finals.
Another problem in Cleveland, as far as I'm concerned, and Brian, you touched on him pretty early on, Kyrie Irving. He looks to be playing for himself so often now compared to last year and in years past. And obviously, there are lots of rumblings about him and LeBron not getting along. But this guy is just dribbling himself into weird shots, like dribbling himself into the corner and then taking a fadeaway. And it's remarkable how low IQ he's looked this year compared to when he actually started out without LeBron. He was actually looking like a decent IQ player, at least offensively. Defensively, he's been a train wreck throughout the course of his career. But I'm not sure that this guy is no longer buying into the entire system. And I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with Lou, but just the roster. I think he feels that this was supposed to be his team. Now LeBron comes in, he gets Kevin Love there, and Kyrie is sort of left in purgatory. It's really difficult to get a lot of high egos to mesh well, but this particular instance looks like a train wreck at times, especially the way they just disregard one another on the court. We have so many examples, especially video examples, of guys standing completely wide open in a corner, screaming and yelling for the ball, and either Kyrie or LeBron goes to take the drive instead. It's not winning basketball.
Yeah, I agree. And I ready for a hot take? I think if Miami stays in the 4 or the 5 spot, I think they beat Cleveland in the second round. I don't think Cleveland even makes it to the Eastern Conference Finals, because Miami just matches up so well against Cleveland. Cleveland hasn't beaten Miami in Miami since LeBron came back. And I really think since they got Joe Johnson, they've been really good. Lost to the Lakers last night aside. So I could definitely see a Miami upset over Cleveland in the second round. And then, good God, all of the hot takes will be phenomenal, because LeBron James is not going to be pleased.
I have a hot take to your hot take. If that happens, LeBron goes back to Miami.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which would be the funniest thing ever. A couple of years ago, I wrote a post basically joking that LeBron, he's going to switch between the Cavs and the Heat in the foreseeable future. Like, he's going to go back to the Cavs, then he's going to go back to Miami, back to the Cavs. I would love it if he just got this unique contract for every other year he played for the other franchise. It's like, that could be amazing. But I think Miami is legitimately in play, because there's all this talk about the team or the guys from the 2003 draft, you know, wanting to get together and all that. I could see it happening, especially if Miami can't re-sign Hassan Whiteside. You know, with the increased cap, you could sign LeBron, re-sign Wade to a respectable deal. And, well, the thing is, though, if you're Pat Riley, do you want him back, Sarah?
That's tough, because I remember him, you know, you remember he went through the media to kind of try to throw down and shame him into staying after they lost in 2014. He was saying, you know, you don't run, you stay together when this kind of thing happens. And then obviously LeBron left, but I think he probably swallows his pride and takes him back if LeBron wanted to come back. To go back to what you said about Kyrie, what was strange about their last game against the Rockets, I felt like they were trying to move the ball. Like, the first half, even into the third quarter a little bit, they really were swinging it around. Kyrie was passing it more than we've seen in a while, I thought. I don't know, you guys have to tell me what you thought if you saw that game. But and then they ended up losing because their transition defense was a wreck in the fourth quarter. But, you know, it seemed like, I don't know if it was just because LeBron wasn't playing, they thought, hey, we better move it around a little bit. But it certainly looked a little more unselfish to start out that game. I don't know if they'll continue that or not, but it was interesting.
I think he had, I want to say he had 8 assists that night. Which,
yeah, he did.
You know, in a lot of those LeBron-less games, he ends up taking 20-plus shots and then usually gets like 5 or fewer assists. So I think you're onto something, that he was a little more unselfish than he usually is. You know, I just think they need to stop pretending that he needs to be the primary ball handler and let LeBron do it, and then have him coming off slashing more, because that's his strength. Like,
right.
He He doesn't need to just be dribbling the air out of the ball. Just let LeBron take over more of that and see what happens.
I saw the game, and yeah, I would agree that it seems like he finds some sort of interest in playing when LeBron isn't around, which is concerning in itself, I would say. But yeah, it does appear to be that when he knows that it's his team, he really gets on it. That could actually be kind of interesting. Like, let's just for a minute play around with the thought that LeBron might get a nagging injury in the playoffs. I don't hope for that on anyone because I like good basketball. But it could be interesting to see how Kyrie would fare without LeBron for like a small extended period of time, like 5, 6 games or something like that. Because it does seem like LeBron is the, I don't want to say architect of him not being as productive or whatnot, but he seems to carry some importance in how Kyrie is playing. And it's obviously significant given that those are the two primary players on Cleveland. I mean, you know, you need both of them to play well. You actually need all three of those guys with Love to play well. And but at this point, Love is just as big a question mark as anything. Like, what do you really do? Zach Lowe proposed making Love the second option, and then Kyrie basically going three style as the third option. I don't hate that. I really don't. I think that could have some benefits. Like, if you just went to Kyrie and told him, okay, just like Brian, what you said, like, move off the ball, cut, cut, cut. And when you have a chance for isolation and you know you can get to the rim, do it. Take spot ups. Just go crazy. Shoot the ball when you're open. Don't focus on the ball handling duties. Just shoot.
Yeah, it's worth remembering that the Miami Heat, when he was there, they didn't really hit their stride until Bosh, I think he had an abdominal strain against the Pacers in 2012. He went out in the second round. And then that was the series where LeBron and Wade really seemed to figure out, oh, okay, we don't need to just play your turn, my turn. Here's how we can both thrive. So, unless LeBron and Kyrie figure that out in the next 2 weeks, and you know, I thought, again, Love's injury last year might have been a catalyst for that. I just don't know how they can radically change in such a short time.
So moving on to the Bulls, you mentioned them, Brian. I'm having, you know, I'm crying a little bit right now, remembering back to that game. I've been on the Bulls should lose from here on out train for a while. I think they have awful management, and I think it's time to hit the reset button. Apparently, the Bulls did not share that feeling, especially at the deadline when they had a chance to trade Pau Gasol to Sacramento. But yeah, apparently Jimmy Butler is now being well, not shot, but they're considering making a move this summer and sending him off for draft picks and basically rebuilding. Now, in my eyes, that's a necessary evil. I love Jimmy Butler. He's one of the primary elite wings in this game. As far as I'm concerned, the best shooting guard in basketball right now. But yeah, it's just necessary. At this point, the Bulls just need to retool or actually rebuild entirely from start to finish. Like, they have to start at a managerial level and go down individually in the roster and just get younger, more explosive, get draft picks involved, because there's no way the Bulls will remain relevant if they hang on to their current roster.
Morton, I'm curious, what is the bare minimum return you would want for Jimmy?
The bare minimum return is a Brooklyn pick for this year via Boston. The Dallas pick via Boston, and yeah, Amir Johnson to match salaries, of course, and then a future Boston-owned pick. That would be the minimum. But what I would expect for Butler, especially given his talent, is two of the Brooklyn picks, and then no Dallas pick. Then I can live with that.
So this year's Brooklyn pick, 2018, a Boston pick, Amir Johnson. No current players.
No, I'm good. I mean, if they were to offer like Marcus Smart or one of the youngsters, obviously, but I think Boston is way too bright to do that. I think they want to keep the young guys involved because they have low salaries and they want to go out and make a splash. I've said this for a while. I think Boston is going to go all in for Jimmy Butler in terms of a trading is a trade target, and then they're going to go all in for Al Horford at the free agency period. So they're going to have an Horford Butler upgrade season, and then they're going to be rocking the East for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. You know, Martin, when you first mentioned trading Jimmy about a week ago, I was taken aback, but the more that I sit with it, the more sense it makes, especially seeing that Boston apparently was interested. I think Boston, like you said, they have to be careful because you don't want to give away too many of your young guys, but if they can just give away picks, I think it's probably a good move for both teams. And the idea seems to be catching on. I've seen so many Jimmy Butler trade ideas floating around on the timeline today, and only one of them was from you, Morton.
And just to reiterate, I love Jimmy Butler. I absolutely love Jimmy Butler. I mean, look at the three Pacers games he's closed this year. He's had a game-winning block on Paul George, a game-winning tip-in on Paul George, and now, just a couple of days ago, he had a game-winning jumper after Paul George got confused on a pick and roll. So Jimmy has just tortured the Indiana Pacers and have, in general, just tortured a lot of teams, going off for 53 against your Philly, Bri, in a comeback win. I know it was Philly, but still. And the 40-point second half against Toronto, which was just ridiculous. I love his game. I love his demeanor. I love the fact that he gets the three-throw line. I love the fact that he defends, that he rebounds, he passes the basketball. For me, I would love to hang on to him, but he's going to be 27 this year. So when a new team or a new rebuilding process is going to be slightly finished, it's going to be 4 years away when he's 31. And at that point in time, you don't want to have a 31-year-old mixed up with a bunch of 23-year-old kids. It just doesn't add up. You want to have prime players who are in like age 26, 27, that age group, basically. So I just think it makes sense. But, man, I would hate losing. Of course I would. He's tremendous. But, yeah, it just makes sense moving into Boston. Also because I like Boston. Could you imagine, you know, the Celtics and Warriors / Spurs going at it for the next 3 or 4 years? That could be fun.
Mm-hmm. It would be so annoying because Boston is already in such a good situation in terms of their cap space. Like, Jay Crowder signed to a below-market deal, Isaiah Thomas is, and Jimmy's on a max deal. But a max deal now compared to a max deal of 2 years, there's going to be a huge difference. You know, almost, I think, seven or eight million per year difference. So that's good. Like, that contract is going to look so much better in 2 years' time, and it's going to free up Boston to do that kind of thing you said, Morton, like go after the Al Horfords, go after someone who can really help round out their roster. Yeah, I would be super annoyed, but that said, I think. You know, if I was a Chicago fan, I would want at least a Brooklyn pick, at least one other first rounder, Amir to help round out the front court, and because you need him for salary, and Marcus Smart as well, because then that gives you, you know, you got to figure Derrick Rose, this could be his last year in Chicago after coming up in 2016-17, so Smart gives you that potential point guard of the future as well.
Moving on to our Amazing Happens segment, and Brian, let's kick it off with one of the major stories coming out this year, actually. D'Angelo Russell and Nick Young. I didn't want to pick up this story, but as you actually told me, there is some basketball-related consequences, I should say, basically, into this entire story.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to steer clear of the Kyrie Irving, Kawhi stuff because that is not basketball related. But D'Angelo, apparently his fellow teammates are icing him out after he secretly recorded Nick Young admitting that he cheated on his fiance and uploaded to Snapchat, not understanding that people can record a Snapchat video and repost it. So apparently it's caused a lot of turmoil in the Lakers locker room. ESPN, I think Baxter Holmes and Mark Stein were the ones to break the news Tuesday night. And I'm actually writing a Lakers season eulogy or season autopsy for B-Ball Breakdown at the moment. So as I was writing Tuesday night, I see this scroll across the timeline, and I just deleted the whole thing because I'm just going to write 2,500 words on this. You know, I mean, a lot of NBA players have come out and said, look, we need... I would never play with this guy. I would never trust this guy. If I was the GM, I think Rajah Bell was the one who said, if I was the Lakers GM, I would trade him right now. So it does make you wonder, are they going to be able to move past this? Because, let's be honest, if Nick Young is icing you out, who cares? He's Nick Young. You're going to try to trade him anyway, or maybe just stretch mm-hmm. him. Like, he's not an important part of the future. Same goes for Lou Williams, who apparently, like, wouldn't talk to D'Angelo this week. The only two people that matter are Jordan Clarkson and Julius Randle, because they're the only two players on the roster who look like potential building blocks. You've got, like, you know, Larry Nance and Anthony Brown are decent players, but you're not going to decide whether to trade a number two overall pick because Larry Nance doesn't get along with him. It's Clarkson and Randle that are the big question marks. So, you know, it is worth keeping an eye on how Russell coexists with those guys, and I don't think it'll be apparent on the court, but hopefully we get some more reporting from team sources inside the locker room to see how that plays out, because holy hell, if they have to trade D'Angelo Russell this offseason and Sam Hinkie is not offering Jahlil Okafor plus whatever else he needs to throw in, I'm out. I'm out on the Sixers. I'll become a Bulls fan. I don't care. Like, I
don't do that to yourself. It,
this is this is just the perfect chance to atone. The Lakers screwed us last year. Let's just redo both guys. Both Okafor and Russell had some negative off-court stuff. They both have baggage. Let's just swap them, throw in some pick considerations. Let's get it done, guys.
The Sixers are so young, too. You know, hopefully they wouldn't freeze him out also, but... They at least have Brett Brown, who, from listening to him talk personally, is a no-nonsense guy, so he could probably get that under control. But this whole thing is just insane. I can't believe that it happened, but it did.
I can't believe how anyone is really targeting D'Angelo Russell here. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, I didn't want to go into it, but I can't help myself right now. He wasn't the one cheating. He wasn't the one doing things he shouldn't be doing. I mean, okay, I get it's really bad recording someone and not telling them. It's, in fact, I believe it's illegal. But, you know, from an ethical standpoint, he did the right thing. I mean, I even believe Iggy sent out a tweet like, thanks, bro. Yeah. So
she said, I thought it was a good video.
Well, Morton, you gotta understand, you have to feel bad for Nick. I mean, it's always very disappointing when someone you thought you could trust turns out to be disloyal. Oh. I just, you know, not to make light of it, but it literally, method aside, it's the same offense. Yeah. They both broke trust. So, I mean, if one of them offends you more than the other, it tells you more probably about yourself than about Russell or Young. And that's good. It's always good to take stock of how you react to things. And if you're fine with how you react to it, then that's cool.
Yeah, I do think this whole morality discussion is interesting because it does seem like Russell's mm-hmm. catching a lot more heat than Nick, even though Nick is the guy, you know, who apparently admitted to cheating on his fiance. That said, I could get why Russell is on blast. Like, it's not as though he was a friend of Iggy Azalea and he was concerned about his mm-hmm. her well-being and just wanted to get this recording so he could show her privately. That would be one thing, and that's, you know, at least relatively honorable. You're still breaking your teammate code of honor or whatever, but at least you're keeping it out of the public's eye. But just to do it as a prank and then to post it online, and it's not like he cares about the well-being of their relationship. He was just being a dick. So I could get why people are putting him on blast, but it does seem like Nick Young, he's gotten off pretty scot-free here, and I don't know that he should be. But I think that probably just speaks to the pervasiveness of infidelity among NBA players, that it's not a huge surprise that one is cheating on his fiance.
It's really been a gossip-filled NBA season, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Really. I mean, it's social media has taken the coverage of this league to a whole new level. So many articles out there about what happens behind closed doors. Just imagine if you had Twitter in the 1980s, just internet generally. Oh, the
Yeah.
things we wouldn't know.
Like Charles Barkley.
Yeah.
Early Charles Barkley. Or I mean, like, imagine if there is Twitter with Wilt Chamberlain.
Yeah, just how many women did he impregnate that we don't
Right.
know about?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Like he would, oh my God.
Or Michael
We
Jordan practices.
Yeah.
Could you imagine Twitter after he punched Steve Kerr?
No.
My God.
Oof. Yeah. Well, okay, so let's move on from that because I already feel ashamed that we've spoken about this for 10 minutes. Going back to the Thunder for a minute, they played the Pistons and lost, and Reggie Jackson was kind of celebrating, and both Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant took major offense to this. I'm not really sure they would have had it been anyone other than Reggie Jackson, but it was Reggie. And now Durant called the celebration for Bush League, and I believe that Russell Westbrook said some words that I can't repeat right here. It was interesting. There's really some bad blood there.
Yeah, I cannot wait for the first Pistons OKC game next year. That's gonna be Westbrook. You know how like Patrick Beverley who plays like he's trying to take someone's head off all the time?
Yeah.
Westbrook is going to actually murder Reggie Jackson on the court. It's gonna be our first televised NBA murder, and it is going to be amazing.
Oh, that sounds so wrong.
The funny thing is, the Spurs were just in OKC, and I think sat, what, the big three and LaMarcus and Kawhi? And the Thunder, being the Thunder, had no problem, jumping up and down on the bench and celebrating like they usually do when they finally pulled away, which took past halftime, by the way. But so it's just funny to me that they would even take exception. It's kind of silly. But like you said, it's because of who it is. But I don't know, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I like that KD pointed out that the whole team didn't play and then said we would have beat the hell out of them if it did. It's just But yeah, as you said, that's pretty hypocritical of them to cover out and be upset 3 days after preening when they're beating Boban and Jonathan Simmons all night.
And yeah, just we're gonna go all out gossip and feuds this week because we have another one on our hands. Boogie Cousins and George Karl. Oh man, basically he protected Seth Curry, which I appreciate. Boogie did, but I'm actually surprised that the George Karl experiment is still active at this point. I would have assumed
Yeah.
that by like the All-Star break he would have been fired, and there were even rumblings about it at that point in time. I just think the Sacramento decided to keep him on for PR purposes, not to appear completely idiotic to fire another head coach that soon into his tenure. I mean, I think Sacramento has become like this constant source of humor, basically. If you wanna have a good laugh, you just go to Google, search King's Antics and filter it for the last 24 hours and you'll get something.
Oh, like Rajon Rondo and Boogie getting technicals for clapping at an
Like that,
official?
yeah.
Yeah. Boogie getting his 16th technical and earning a suspension because he just, in the like last seconds of a game that they're clearly gonna win, he just couldn't help himself with being sarcastic.
So I have a question regarding
It's just.
Boogie in general because he there's a lot of shade being thrown at Boogie and has been for his entire career, but Sarah, there is no question that DeMarcus is a hell of a player. like he's one of the leading players in the entire league, best center. He's even added a 3-point shot to his arsenal. What kind of team do you think he needs to be on where you can actually tunnel that aggressiveness and his mindset into being productive?
Well, clearly he should be a Spur.
Oh my God.
No, that's a good question. He definitely needs a coach that can kind of level with him, make him understand, you know, things beyond basketball. I care about you beyond basketball, and maybe he'll listen to that person. But I don't have high hopes for him really changing very much. He's been in the league how many years already? And, you know, that's been the story his entire career. Is, oh, man, he's so talented. If he could just get a handle on his emotions a little bit. But it hasn't happened. So I don't know how much more he's really going to mature.
But as an organization, don't you have the responsibility to actually develop your players under the best possible circumstances? Because when you yin-yanging coaches in and out, including the one coach that actually reached you in Mike mm-hmm. Malone, isn't the organization just begging to see itself blow up, basically, in the face of Cousins here? Because I understand his frustration level. I understand that he looks at management as a complete cluster or something, and the same for the coaching staff. It seems like there's never any stability, and when you have a guy that's this talented but also this emotional, you need stability. Stability is the number one key word here, and they have provided none of it. So while I agree that he has this tendency to be very emotional and sometimes damaging, I really put that on the feet of the Sacramento Kings, honestly.
Sure.
Yeah, three quick things. One, last night was the first time that the Kings have won 30 games with Cousins. This is now his sixth year in the league. Wow. So anyone who is concerned about the detrimental effects of a losing culture need only look at Boogie. Two, Morton, you said it. Like, they just should have never fired Mike Malone. He was the only guy they've had who's connected with Boogie, and we've seen him in Denver. He's a good coach. Like, he knows what he's doing. He connects with his players. If you have a guy who is has the reputation of being hot-headed, and you have a coach who's connecting with him, win-loss record almost doesn't matter at that point, especially after you're firing him because Boogie got sick with meningitis. Like, it was just the most short-sighted decision the Kings have made in quite some time, which says a lot because they're the Kings, and they make short-sighted decisions all the time. And three, in terms of where he needs to go, Morton, I hate to do this to you, but I kind of think he's perfect in Boston. I think they need to save their ammo and target him instead of Jimmy, just because, a lot of their big men are young and are about to be restricted free agents or coming up for extensions. B, Brad Stevens and Boogie just seems unfair. Like, that, I don't see how that doesn't work out, because Brad Stevens really seems to develop a strong connection with all of his players, and all of those guys want to go to war for him. And he's a great in-game strategist, so, like, God help the NBA if Boogie actually has a good coach. And also, he'd be reunited with Isaiah Thomas, and it would be, I want to see a reality show with the two of them, because that would be, it would be perfect.
I like the idea of Boogie going to Boston. It would be kind of amazing to get both Jimmy and Cousins if you can manage your draft picks correctly, as well as cash in on the young guys. Potentially, you could make that happen. That would be quite a summer. Butler and Cousins. Yeah. I mean, you could wrap up the Eastern Conference for the next 5 years if you're Boston. Let's stick to the Kings for a bit, because Brian, you touched on this. They're the Kings, and they make weird decisions. And right now, Lottie Divas has received a contract extension. I even believe he signed it. My only question is, with that contract, was there a sports corporate finances book for dummies attached? Because that's sort of required. This is a dude who still hasn't understood the complexities of the salary cap. Which I sort of get on the surface because it is complicated, but, you know, if you get that job, you need to understand and you need to put in the work. Now the Kings are going to find him an executive to work alongside with, but man, that's an awful lot of special treatment just to have your guy in place.
Yeah, I just don't get, I mean, it sounds like they are going to hire someone to manage the more difficult complexities of the CBA, but like, that's your job as a general manager. That is literally what you're getting paid to do. So why are you keeping him if he's not going to do the job of a general manager? Just hire someone who actually knows how the CBA works and call it a day. It makes no sense unless they want to keep sending pick swaps to Philadelphia, in which case, Vlade Divac forever.
Yeah, well, you know, the Sixers brought in Colangelo to help Hinkie, so there's precedent for really well-run organization doing that, so why not? Why not? Just go
that,
for it.
That was cold-blooded.
I'm sorry, Brian.
No, you know what? I'm also being a little bit harsh on Vlade. It's just, you know, it's so Kings. It's really not Vlade, it's the Kings. When that report surfaced a couple of months ago that Vlade didn't understand the CBA, it was like, of course he doesn't. Because there just has to be another thing wrong with the Kings. Just another problem arising. It's just, it's the never-ending story. Which brings me to my next question, Brian. When will this team get it together? Are we talking about when Vivek Ranadive is gone as the primary owner? Or are we looking at, you know, a change in coaching staff? Or are we looking at an organization who's just about there in terms of figuring stuff out, in terms of how things need to be handled?
Oh, hell no. Not the last one. Definitely not the last one. I mean, it really depends on what they're going to do with Boogie, but George Karl is definitely gone after this year. There's just no way that they can keep him around. All of his players have quit on him. It's not just Boogie. I mean, Rudy Gay has come out and said this is the hardest year he's ever had. Karl is also undermining Willie Cauley-Stein at every possible opportunity. Like, every time he scores 20 points, Karl comes out after the game and says, oh, well, we just set him up for a bunch of easy lobs and dunks. Like, all right, guy, that's your next franchise center in theory, so maybe don't pull a Byron Scott and slam him all the time. I mean, I think they're going to have to trade Boogie this offseason just because we've gone to the point, past the point of no return, in which case you're starting at square one again. So, I mean, God, like, I don't see any upside for the next half decade. Is that, like, is that mean to say? Because if they could swap their, I mean, if the Sixers, like, if the Kings win the lottery, the Sixers are going to take their pick. If the Kings win the lottery next year, the Sixers are going to take their pick. And then the Sixers have an unprotected first round pick coming in 2019 from them. So a lot of their draft compensation could be worse than you would expect for a team this bad. And then if you're starting from scratch with really probably Willie Cauley-Stein, a bunch of other draft picks, and then you're probably trading Rudy Gay too, and Rajon Rondo is definitely leaving. Like, you have no one in place aside from Cauley-Stein. So I don't see how you're going to be competing for a spot in the Western Conference anytime soon.
So basically the Nets of the West.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Such a good way to put it. Yes, the Nets of the West.
Oh, well, that's depressing. I see a team owner who just has no grasp of the NBA game and the way to conduct NBA business. And that's really always been a problem with new owners, that when they come in, they treat NBA teams like corporate, you know, brands that they've used to run, and they don't really understand the complexities that is the NBA. But now that Vivek has been there for like 3 or 4 years, he should have gained a higher understanding at least of how things operate. And it doesn't seem like that's the case. So I'm looking at ownership here. That's really the key for me. This is Vivek Ranadive's do or die time. And if he keeps sinking this team lower and lower and lower, at some point, team owners are going to have to look at him and like, yeah, you're not going to turn a profit this year again. You're not going to, you're not even competitive. You're actually hurting the NBA brand by your mere presence. So I could see him be squeezed out eventually. I wouldn't.
Yeah. It sounds like there's a power struggle between him and the minority owners of the Kings. So I don't know if there's like a way for them to stage a coup d'etat against him, but it does make you wonder. You know, no team is going to be really good until their ownership and their front office are all on the same page, and their coaches. So right now, if their ownership is divided, the front office and the coach has no chance. So they need to get their ducks in a row between Vivek and the other owners first, then figure out their front office and whatever the hell they're doing with Vlade, then get a good coach. Then and only then can they start to actually build towards something that has a chance of winning more than 35 games.
Let's turn the discussion over to something way more positive. Our weekly crush, which is a segment that, each of us, we select our crush for the week, a player or a team that we particularly enjoy. And let's start off with you, Brian, because you chose Tobias Harris of the Detroit Pistons.
My man. Yeah, like... I feel like he's kind of flown under the radar how good he's been in Detroit, because for whatever reason, Detroit just isn't attracting all that much media attention. But, so, I mean, keep this sample size in mind. It's only 21 games, so it's not like we can draw substantive conclusions yet. But he's averaged 16.4 points, 6.1 rebounds, 2.8 assists, and 1.2 threes. He's shooting above 47% overall, above 36% on threes, and above 90% on free throws. If this was a whole season, which, again, it's not, but if it was, he'd be setting career highs in PER, true shooting percentage, and box plus minus. So he's been great. And it's not hard to figure out why. Like, he has the skill set to be an ideal stretch four next to Drummond. And because opponents have to devote so much attention to Reggie Jackson Drummond pick and rolls, just having him spot up for the perimeter as a catch and shoot kind of guy, like, he's perfect for that role. And he can create his own offense. The Pistons are 13-8 with him in the lineup. So it's not like his success is coming at the expense of the team. I just can't believe that Stan Van Gundy pilfered him for the expiring contract of Brandon Jennings and then Ersan Ilyasova, who can also think he's got a little bit of money guaranteed for next year, but one would assume Orlando is also going to waive him. They didn't have to give up a first-round pick for a 23-year-old on a very reasonable contract who is a perfect fit for the team. Like, Stan Van Gundy is in my top three for executive of the year just because of this trade.
I like the point that he's flying under the radar because of Drummond's and Reggie Jackson's pick-and-roll abilities. Because when the defense collapses on those guys, it's not just his ability, Tobias Harris's, that mm-hmm. is, to stretch the floor. He can actually get the ball and take those two hard dribbles towards the basket because he has this strong physique. He's 6'9", like 240, and he can get to the rim. So when someone closes out on him hard, he does this one fake and he puts the ball on the floor and can really just go hard to the rim. And this just puts so much... This collapses the defense so much that it actually frees up Drummond to get offensive rebounds, or you can even see Harris at times make the small drop-off fast to Drummond, who then jams it home or passes it out further to Reggie Jackson, who now is somewhat open from the outside. It just adds so much complexity to their offense, which I really enjoy, and Stan Van Gundy knows exactly how to utilize him. It looks a little bit like he's using him in the same vein as Rashard Lewis back in Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, he's like the perfect... I mean, you had to figure when Stan came to Detroit and had Drummond, he would try to build a roster similar to those late 2000s Magic teams where they have Dwight in the middle and then four shooters around him. And, yeah. I mean, Tobias, He didn't come in with the reputation of being a great three-point shooter. He only had one season above 33%. But if he keeps shooting like this, Orlando's gonna look even dumber than they did at the deadline.
So, Sarah, your weekly crush.
Full disclosure, I had an insane moment where I was considering picking Montrezl Harrell from the Rockets. Not for anything he's done on the floor, because he doesn't really get to play, but just I was like strangely, irrationally disappointed when the Spurs passed on him and RJ Hunter in the draft. And I just for the season that the Rockets are having, and with most of their problems being stemming from inconsistent effort, I just wondered why he couldn't get on the floor more. But a few days ago, I saw that he's doing a stint in the D League, and he apparently pushed a referee and got suspended for 5 games. So today is not the day for Montrez. Maybe another day. So I'm gonna go with a Spur, actually. My weekly crush is Kyle Anderson, slow-mo. I just love his game. A part of it is vanity, because I feel like, back in my glory days, we played the same style, right down to the fact that he looks like he's running in quicksand. That's very me. But he's getting more time lately now that Pop is in full-on maintenance mode. And in 36 minutes at Memphis the other night, he had 13 points, 3 rebounds, 7 assists, 4 steals, and 1 block. And over the last 3 games, he's averaging 7 points, 3.5 rebounds, 4.5 assists, 2.5 steals in 27 minutes. He's just got a great game. His release is super slow. I don't know if Chip England is ever going to hopefully be able to get that a little quicker, but he's shooting better this year. He's up from 34% last year to about 47% this year. He's still working on his 3-point shot, getting that more consistent. He's below 30% right now, but he's got a decent shot. He can handle the ball. He was basically a point guard in college. He's even though he's not quick, he's got the length to kind of make up for that on defense. He's smart, and my favorite thing about him is his passing. I love the way he passes the ball. The other day in Memphis, he on the defensive end, he came over to cut off this drop-off pass on the help side. And he ran the break, and he was actually able to use his slowness to kind of lull the entire defense to sleep. And then he hit Patty Mills with this nice bounce pass for the layup. So I just love watching him play the game. He's very deliberate. He's never in a hurry. It's fun to watch. Hopefully he gets some playoff minutes. He said his goal this whole season has been to earn some playoff minutes, and I think he has. Oh, hopefully he has. Just a few anyway.
He's one of those guys where the Spurs drafted him, and immediately you say, "Oh God, he's going to be so good in 3 years." Like, I know he's athletically limited, but he just has that all-around game. Like, he is their next Boris Diaw, and it's going to be so upsetting.
Remember in Summer League when he would continuously run fast break, slow-footed, and steal complete plays because he just threw people off? It's like people just were over-aggressive, and he was just so calm that people would just go after blocks, and he would just lay them out and then just go up for like small layups. And the great thing about it was everyone in the gym knew it was coming. They just didn't know how to stop it. You couldn't stop the slowness. You just couldn't. But he's the type of guy that when I look back at like some of the epic NBA final series that's been throughout the course of the league history, he's one of those guys that come in from the bench and makes a difference. He's the guy who can come in, play 5 minutes and not make a mistake,
Right.
make 2 or 3 passes that are just right on the money, no turnovers, grabbing essential boards, pushing the tempo, hitting an open shot, and just doing his part in gaining that championship. So I really look forward to seeing him get significant playoff minutes, and for him that's about 12 to 15 minutes. If he could get that would be pretty spectacular. I understand that he averages 15 on the year, but yeah, I mean, given his current streak where he's looking real good, I could see Pop giving him some leash.
And he's one of those guys, like, when you win a championship, You can't just rely on your big three or your top three or four guys. Like, there's always one game where some completely under the radar dude goes off for like 25 points in 20 minutes and just swings the complexion of that game. Anderson is that guy. Like, he could totally, he's not going to win you a whole series, but he could absolutely be a ringer off the bench one time, win you a game, and then that's only three left.
And that in itself carries its weight in gold, right? I mean, when you look at it, what is that type of win worth? If you're looking in the finals where you need to win four games, that's like $10 million worth when you look at it. My crush is the Denver Nuggets, surprisingly. And Brian, I'm so sorry to do this to you and your Sixers, but they're doing such good job at rebuilding, the Nuggets are, and it's really what the Sixers should have been doing, the same model. I mean, they have so much going for themselves. I mean, you have Danilo Gallinari, who's 27, 28, still in his prime, and the Nuggets are right there. They can actually be a playoff team by next year if they hit on all cylinders. So that means he's young enough to be part of the established core going forward. Gary Harris has shown tremendous improvements. Emmanuel Mudiay has had his best month in March and seems to be, you know, grasping the NBA game a little bit better. Will Barton has been an animal throughout. I mean, he's just one of the best six men in a while, actually. Nikola Jokic, Joffrey Laverne, Yusuf Nurkic, the three-headed center monster here. I mean, all doing their thing, different rebounding, scoring, stretching. What can't they do, really? And then they have a truckload of picks coming in this year alone. I am really digging Denver's rebuilding process and how they are flying completely under the radar.
They also have Wilson Chandler coming back from, I think he had a hip injury. So he's that's another guy. I don't believe he's all that old. I think he's around the same age as Gallinari or maybe a little bit older.
Yeah, I think 28.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, they're set up to be sneaky good next year. I think a lot depends on what they do with Fareed in the offseason.
I would trade him. He's not a strong defender. He is not a good shooter either. He's actually regressed in that area. He's begun scoring closer to the rim now again. He experimented in previous years with taking mid-range shots, and he's kind of dropped that aspect of his game because it just didn't result in anything positive, and he's gambling a lot. You know, I like him as an energy player, but I don't like him as a featured power forward. So you could make an argument of hanging on to him as long as you then get a better power forward in his place. Maybe you slot Nikola Jokic down and play real big, but in today's game where you need to play a little bit small, that might not be the best thing to do. It depends, but there are some options there at least.
Yeah, I mean, they could always even try Gallo and Chandler at the three and the four, some combination. Yeah. And then, yeah, I think Fareed, if he sticks around, you probably want to move him to the bench, give him 25 minutes a night, basically make him like a very rich man's Thomas Robinson.
Yeah. That's actually not a bad comparison. The biggest thing for me, though, Will Barton is locked up for the next 2 years after this for $3.6 and $3.9 million. For his production, he has to be in the top 20 of the best contracts in the NBA, if not top 10, actually. It's ludicrous how well he's playing right now for that money. And it provides the Nuggets a chance to upgrade their roster while not having to dip into the Will Barton extension fund anytime soon. The key here is that he's on that short deal or that small deal when the 2017 summer rolls around with the cap explodes completely to the 108 mark. The Nuggets could legitimately be a frightening team in 2 years. That's ridiculous to think about.
And they have a boatload of draft picks coming this year, right?
Yeah, they're going to be fun. They're one of those teams to watch with Minnesota and Utah that are coming.
And for our last segment, the depressed fan scale. And Brian, this is your show. This is a 1 to 10 rating of how depressed one could be. One is Sarah, basically, because she's a Spurs fan. And Brian, where are you this week with the Philadelphia 76ers?
You know, I'm actually only about a 6 right now, believe it or not. Wow. Yeah, I know. Well, because one, there's the light at the end of the tunnel, and there's only like 7 or 8 more games that I have to watch this team. And then hopefully, God willing, we'll have Dario Saric and Joel Embiid and a bunch of draft picks and some free agents come in. So the Sixers being as bad as they are, hopefully is coming to an end soon, and I can finally taste that. But in the meantime, they are still searching for their 10th win to avoid tying the 1972-73 Sixers for the worst record in NBA history, which is a really fun thing to be striving for the last couple weeks. But because New Orleans has maybe a half of a healthy player left, now that Jrue Holiday is done for the year, the Sixers play them at home on April 5th. And if they don't win that game, I'm going to be a 13 out of 10 on this scale because they're actually going to tie the 72-73 Sixers. But aside from that, now we're just looking at lottery picks and draft considerations. And they've got the number one, or at least the worst record, sealed up. So they're going to have the best odds. Also means they're not going to slip any lower than 4. The Kings are starting to rest players or get players suspended for clapping a referees. So the Sixers can pick swap with them if the Kings go ahead and win the number one pick. So every loss for the Kings is going to bump up those odds just a little bit more. And, you know, Nerlens is hurt. Jahlil Okafor is out for the year. But Elton Brand's playing, and I love Elton Brand, and he's playing well. So it just makes me happy to see him playing just once more in a Sixers uniform, because chances are he's going to retire at the end of the season, and this time it's going to be for good.
I can't wait for a week from now, or to a week from now when Philly has lost to New Orleans.
It's going to be so bad. I'm going to do this podcast just rip-roaringly drunk because I'm not going to stop drinking until they actually win a game.
So you're basically going to be drinking to like October.
Yeah, right. I'm going to be like in the hospital recording, getting my stomach pumped.
Oh, no.
And Sarah, do we even need to ask you?
Yeah, not really. I'm kind of at a zero, not applicable today. I'm sure heartbreak is coming sometime in the playoffs, but so there's a sense of foreboding. But I've resolved to just really enjoy everything we have left. So I'm just going to enjoy the run as much as I can. But we're happy today.
I'm not envious at all. No. Oh, yeah.
Morton, how are you feeling after the Bulls kept their playoff hopes alive the other night?
I'm at about an 8 now, because I just want them to lose. They still keep that little fight in them. They're still so inconsistent, and all their troubles are still there. And they had a team meeting and then went out and lost. That was a good thing, because that just showed that there's absolutely no way this team is going to get fully back on track. But you know, I could just see that they squeezed out that last playoff spot, and I hate that. So I would feel so much more comfortable if they just lost 5 straight and be done with it. That would be my key here. So yeah,
it's gonna be very Bulls when they. I think they get the Sixers as their last game of the season. So
please beat
you
us.
And I, yeah, you and I will both be rooting for the Sixers that night.
Yeah, yeah. Thing is, though, I've lost all interest for the Bulls this year. Like, all interest. It's not even funny how many Bulls fans have actually just stopped watching the team lately. I mean, it's not just the effort. It's the thing that everyone knows that management is too involved and makes these horrible decisions. And Fred Hoiberg right now is a rookie coach who honestly looks pretty poor, but you can't put it all at his feet. Fair enough. But it's just such a mess from a management level, coaching level, player level, and if they have any ideas of trying to replicate this team next year just with a draft pick or another 35-year-old veteran signed in free agency, I'm going to jump off the train and I'm just going to join Sarah on the San Antonio wagon.
Come on over.
I'm really going to do that because My heart can't stand. Jeez.
I think it's worth wondering who's going to be more depressed, you when they sign Pau Gasol for $20 million, or me when the Sixers fall to number four in the draft.
Don't do this to me, Bri. I'm just that's not
fair. Gotta prepare ourselves for the worst here.
But the thing about it, though, getting the fourth pick, that's not a bad thing. Getting Pau is a bad thing, especially with $20 million. I mean, you could at least get someone decent there. You could get Buddy Hield in there. Pau Gasol, 36-year-old guy getting $20 million a year, that's not a good thing, Bri.
Yeah, you have a fair point. At least at least I won't have to root for Pau Gasol.
And with that, we will wrap up our first episode of the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. Jump on to bballbreakdown.com for more coverage of the league. Lots of different and awesome characters over there, so give that a read and a watch on YouTube, of course. And Brian and Sarah, it was nice recording this first podcast with you, and I'm looking forward to many more.
Sounds good, Martin. It was fun.
Bye.